Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:13 PM, that is Pacific Summer Time, and today is September 11th. Well, I thought I would kick off today and look at the Apple chart, because when I look at this on a log scale over 5 years and I see an overextension relative to the long-term trend mean, which is represented by the 1,000-day moving average, well, I'm tempted to think this is crazy, that there's no possible way that this can continue and that there is a clear potential that we're going to have a significant drawdown. And when we go back and look historically, and maybe even more history, well, we can see that the 1,000-day moving average has been a really rather reliable area of support over much of the bull market since at least 2008. So it's a logical area where we can begin to think about where Apple might begin to find support. The problem is that it would be more than a 50% retracement to get back down there. And there is no denying that the pace of the advance has picked up. And even on a long-term scale, we can see that this slow and steady advance, even though in percentage terms it was really quite acute, has picked up pace since the lows back in February of 2019. So it was already picking up pace before the pandemic, and then the pace of that advance just got back to trend by last week. So we've certainly had acceleration, and acceleration is a trend ending because it represents a time when people are falling over themselves to buy the share, and also a time when valuations are no longer a concern. People just don't care anymore. It's the triumph of value agnostic investing. And then it's also a time where there's limited supply because there's so many people are buying. Of course, the higher the price goes, it means that people are holding supply off the market, and they all become potential sellers in the event that prices decline. So what would really be required to stem this advance? And potentially we've seen a significant pullback, but the reality is that there are a large number of indices that are right in the region of their 50-day moving averages. So rather than concerning ourselves with the 1,000-day moving average, most investors today are much more concerned with the 50-day moving average, which is obviously much more short-term in nature, but it's also representative of leverage. The last time we had a significant triumph of trading relative to the 50-day moving average was in 2017. And looking back at the S&P 500 chart, we can see that the index found support on multiple occasions, all the way through from the result of the presidential election through to the peak in early 2018. The price had bounced repeatedly from the 50-day moving average. So it is a trend mean that tends to be particularly beneficial in strong momentum moves. And that's one of the reasons why people are interested in it today. But if we then just come back and look at Apple in the same terms, we can see that Apple is another share that is right in the region of that 50-day moving average. Now, the reason the 50-day moving average tends to be a point where markets can find support during momentum moves is because it's comparatively close to the price. With the price moving up in a strong way, then the tolerance of leveraged investors for a full pullback towards the 200-day moving average is rather low because of the extent of the the size of the pullback required to get there would blow out their leverage ratios. So then they look for something that is closer to the price. So the 50-day moving average is a logical area to look at. Then we also have the willingness of investors to buy the dip. And in a momentum move, the willingness of people to buy the dip increases the higher the price goes. there's lots of people see the price moving higher and then they say, well, golly, I really want to own it, but I can't pay the all-time new high. I want to wait for a pullback. Then, of course, they panic because they don't know when the price might rebound in an emphatic fashion. So they don't wait for a full pullback to the 200-day moving average, but rather they look for a more opportune point to buy. Now, we are at a point today where we've had a very strong momentum move. We've also had a meaningful pullback, particularly in technology shares. And there are a large number of global indices that are right in the region of their 50-day moving averages. This is a logical area where the momentum crowd will begin to buy the dip. So it's a logical area where we might anticipate some support coming through. Now, if prices fail at this level, then it greatly increases the potential that the next area of potential support will be somewhere in the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, if we go back and then look at some additional charts, well, Apple has been one of the best performers. Then Microsoft has also been doing particularly well. Now, it is below its 50-day moving average, but it is pausing in the region of the psychological $200 area. It hadn't rallied quite as strongly as Apple had. Then when we think about some of the shares that have rallied clearly as strongly as Apple, well, then Nvidia is also right in the region of its 50-day moving average. And again, I have written about this in here today, but it is the region of the trend means is more important than the absolute level, because markets do tend to overshoot on both the upside and the downside, and they do tend to mess around in the region of trend means rather than finding support or resistance specifically near them. But one thing we know is that we've had acceleration. And then we also know that we've had somewhat larger pullbacks. So this is a warning shot that the very strong momentum moves that we've had over the course of the last 6 and 7 months is losing momentum. And we're going to have to see a very clear and sustained rebound in order to demonstrate that this is still a consistent advance overall. When we then think about technology generally, well, technology specifically does particularly well in a low interest rate environment. And of course, we have got extraordinarily low interest rates at present. When we think about the 10-year yield, we are down into levels that really are not all that far away from where they were back in March. And that's a testament to the quantity of money that is poured into this market, whether it is directly from the Federal Reserve printing money to buy bonds, or whether it is because of the desire for safe havens. But yields are still around 66 basis points. Mortgage rates are now at historic lows. So that alone is making about approximately 20 million people in the USA eligible for refinancing. Anyone who refinances at these attractive rates will then have additional money to spend. So it's very stimulative. And this is obviously an additional positive factor for stock markets overall. Now, of course, when we go back and think about 2020 in hindsight, we're going to remember it as a year of natural disasters, but probably most specifically plague. We've had a plague of locusts. We've had the swine flu, which is fatal to any pig that gets it. There has also been a very significant plague in terms of the wildlife population in North America, where deer have been getting this virus as well. Then we have the coronavirus, which has shut down the global economy. Then there's fires. We've had fires in Australia, fires in Brazil, now fires in much of the western portion of the USA. So there are a large number of natural disasters. There are two important points that stem from that. The first is that there's a significant monetary and fiscal stimulus that's likely on the back of all of these factors. So now the question is, when we look at the size of the Fed's balance sheet, they said very clearly back in March that they are going to continue to buy a significant quantity of bonds every month. And that has not happened. They may be rolling over expiring bonds, but there is no new issuance since May. There's no new increasing the size of the balance sheet since May. Then, when we look at what's going on in Europe, well, they haven't been especially aggressive either. So, one thing that has been quite clear is that despite the very significant printing of cash that's occurred since March, the pace of the printing has definitely slowed down over the course of the last few months. And that's part of the reason why we're seeing this pullback on some of the most leveraged investments, because they thrive on liquidity. Now the question is, are we going to have second waves? There are certainly issues in Europe with the number of cases rising, and in the UK, the pace of the number of cases rising has gone exponential again. One thing that is just not being discussed at all is the number of deaths relative to the number of cases, or deaths in absolute terms, because the number of deaths is definitely decreasing. One thing that is heavily reported on are the negative effects of the coronavirus. The one thing that I haven't seen discussed at all is the percentage of people that have extraordinarily mild symptoms, those that have the virus and don't even know they have it. What I have seen lots of stories about is the number of children, or not even the number of children, but every time a child develops a bad case of the virus, it's reported on. And the number of children that have died from the virus is really very small indeed. There are probably, for example, there are approximately 60 to 80 people die from bee stings in a year. And obviously, the number of people dying from the coronavirus is much larger. But if you isolate it down to the people under the age of 30, we're talking about very small numbers. And the number below 20, or the age group below 20, is even smaller again. So these are considerations that need to be taken into account. And quite whether there is a real possibility of lockdowns going back into effect is, I think, rather doubtful, even with the number of cases rising. The reality is that we are now in the second week of September, and it is not surprising that the number of cases would rise now because of the delay from people taking vacations in August. So there's every reason to believe that the spread will not continue at this rate, but that as people get back into their daily routines of working from home and children even being educated from home, that this pace in the of increase in the number of cases will moderate. And of course, that is a prognostication until we in fact see evidence of that, but probably we won't see evidence of that because of the delay in the onset of symptoms for at least another few weeks. So that also contributes to this wait and see attitude in stock markets, that investors are still waiting to see whether the news about the virus is going to get better or worse. And then they're also waiting to see how much of a pullback will be required before central banks will step in and support markets aggressively again. I'm rather hesitant to think that that's the 50-day moving average. It could quite easily be the 200-day moving average, but I think central banks seem to be quite happy to allow a consolidation to take place. When we then think about what's the other ramification? Well, with 2020 being a year of plagues and natural disasters, then there is obviously the question whether this is going to represent a significant uptick in inflationary pressures. Well, there are both push and pull factors relating to inflation. Obviously, when we have the continued pace of technological innovation is deflationary. The fact that we have more people working from home is additionally deflationary because it directly impacts the velocity of money. If we think about how much somebody earns in a month, if they are commuting to work, they are either paying for public transport or they're buying gasoline for their car, then they're either bringing their lunch to work or they're going out for lunch at work. They might go out for drinks after work. There will be dinners to go to. All of these other factors, they increase the velocity of money. If you're working from home, you're not doing any of that. It also contributes to more choice in how you spend your money, but it's certainly deflationary overall. So that's certainly a point that is getting less consideration, I think. Then, of course, we have the continued pace of technological innovation, which is contributing to a additional deflationary forces. The entire raison d'être of technology is to do more with less. The clear trend, particularly for transportation, is towards fewer parts in automotive vehicles, more technology, and again, that is something that is obviously going to allow us to do more with less in the event that we ever do, in fact, get autonomous vehicles. Then that would also be incredibly deflationary. Of course, the continued trend of technology is also a contributing factor in inequality because there are the people that benefit enormously from the generation of new technologies, and then there are those that are dislocated as a result of the introduction of these technologies. And obviously, if we get autonomous vehicles, then that is something that will cut out a very large portion of people that rely on providing transportation for all manner of goods and services. And that's obviously something that could have a very significant impact both on the social makeup of society and also the valuation of various portions of the stock market. When we think about what are the inflationary forces, well, we have obviously had a massive contraction in the velocity of money. And this is not reported with sufficient regularity to have a live figure. But we've definitely had a very significant increase in M2. And M2 is reported more often than velocity of money. So the fact that M2 continues to move higher, although now at a more modest pace, does suggest that velocity of money has been slow to recover. But velocity of money will recover, and most particularly, it'll recover when we have a vaccine. Well, the Nasdaq Biotech Index is now right in the region of its trend mean. AstraZeneca paused its trial of Oxford University's solution in here this week, but then they also mentioned that it is likely that they will have a vaccine approved by Christmas. So the share continues to steady in the region of the trend mean. The problem, of course, for every drug company is that the entire world is paying extreme care and attention to the pace and developments of all clinical trials. And clinical trials do tend to have bumps along the way. But so far, the share continues to hold on. I do rather think, though, that when we think about the potential for gains in the vaccine sector, it's the wider economy will benefit rather than the specific companies. There's 150 different vaccine solutions in development around the world. And there's a good chance that a significant proportion of them will be permissioned. It means that there's going to be a lot of competition for supplying solutions once more and more of these solutions are permissioned. And all of them are being valued now as if they are going to capture the entire market, and that just does not appear to be realizable or even credible. But the fact is that as soon as we get vaccines being rolled out, people are going to surge back into economic activity. One thing that has been very clear is that when people are saving more money because of working from home or because incomes have been supplemented by governments, then they have got more money to spend, and there is a clear demand for social interaction. One thing reported on last week was massive parties in Wuhan, and in response to the end of lockdowns. So these are obviously just outbursts of emotion, and it's quite likely that we're going to have a very significant rebound in economic activity when we get through this virus and lockdown phase. And that will represent a massive uptick in velocity of money. People will be out and spending and doing so with abandon in celebration of the end of 2020. And I think that that could be a very significant inflationary force, because the stock market and financial assets generally are completely addicted to liquidity. So when velocity of money picks back up, then central banks are going to be in a rather tight position. There is a massive amount of debt that has been taken on to tackle the economic contraction, and the only possible way that that is going to be paid back is through inflation, because there was a lot of debt taken on to deal with the credit crisis back in 2008. A number of governments tried to do austerity, and it didn't work, because the only possible way that austerity works is through massive devaluation of the currency. And particularly in the Eurozone, there was no tolerance, or there was really no tolerance again between governments for massive fiscal stimulus and huge money printing to devalue the currency, because that would have been inconvenient for the creditor nations. So there has been this clear populist revolt against diminishing living standards. There is just no way that people are going to stand for an additional decade of austerity. And that pretty much sets us up for very similar conditions to what happened in the early 1970s. 1968 was incredibly difficult in terms of the social agenda. There was massive student protests. There was a clear desire for equality and racial justice. There were these incredible assassinations of noted figures. 1969 was the summer of love, where a lot of the problems were put to the side. But it was the massive response of government to monetize debt, and for the central banks to just simply print the money needed by the government to spend. That was a significant factor. There was an additional significant factor that was a hallmark of the 1970s, which was huge building projects. One of the biggest concerns for many young people is the high cost of housing. And there has been a clear trend in housing, or the NIMBY, not in my backyard, type of revolts against housing regulation, so that there has been a proliferation of single family homes in city centers. Now, that is the kind of thing that could easily change with more social unrest unfolding, because people want housing and they want it cheaper. And that does suggest that we could have a significant building boom. I think that's potentially what lumber prices are beginning to price in. Now, we've had extraordinary volatility in lumber over the course of the last few months, and just in the last 10 sessions, it has moved the limit right off the open. So these limit moves, 3 days on the downside where it opened limit down, and then today opening limit up, this does suggest that there's some dip buying going on, but there's a lot of speculation going on in terms of this incredible price trend we've had over the last 6 months. It's quite potentially possible that we're going to have a significant building boom. Now, that could be both push and pull as well, that people are leaving the cities. Now, that's a trend that's unfolded as a result of the coronavirus and the clear desire to exit the hotspots. But there is the additional point that the millennial generation are now in their 30s, which is prime family formation age. And the move to the suburbs is a logical part of family formation. People want to have more space and they want to be closer to good schools when they have children. So perhaps the pandemic is simply accelerating that trend, but they'll also be demanding more housing. So there is the clear potential that there's going to be a very significant housing boom, and not least because we have extraordinarily low interest rates. Now, that is something that could be not simply a US phenomenon, but also quite clearly a UK phenomenon as well, and elsewhere. And home builders continue to do quite well, and the S&P 500 home building sector continues to hold the breakout to new all-time highs. And it is all-time highs, which I think is particularly relevant, because no one thought that was possible following the crash that we had from the peak back in 2005. And I think that that's something we should be paying attention to, that when we speed forward 12 years, home builders are now at new all-time highs. The conclusions that people are drawing today are that we're not going to travel ever again, that people are going to stop going to stores entirely, or that hotels are going to be denuded of business for a long time, or that all restaurants are going to go bust. Well, one thing I thought was rather interesting is Dufry, which is the big owner of duty-free stores, has been basing now for 6 months, and it is trading at a fraction of the values that it was back in 2017. Now, obviously, it was already going down before the crisis, but it's trading at 30, and it had been steadying around 80 in 2019. When air traffic picks back up again, well, then it's not like people won't be spending money in duty-free stores. I know that Mrs. Tracy has often liked it when I travel to or travel through Heathrow, because a number of the Asian-oriented cosmetics that she likes aren't available in the US market. So she always wants me to go and pick things up in the duty-free, and lots of people are in the same boat. So there is the clear potential that these very depressed sectors are going to be recovery candidates, not perhaps in the short term, but certainly in the medium term. There's just no way that companies like Delta Airlines are going to go bust. Now, that doesn't mean that some of the worst performing airlines are going to also survive, but the reality is that the coronavirus is offering them a unique opportunity to shed their employee load. And it means that they can accelerate the move of people into retirement. And the problem that a lot of these legacy companies have is that their workforces are older. So this does afford them the possibility to revamp their employee headcount. And obviously that's not something that's going to deliver massive returns in the short term. But it's quite likely that we are going to have a significant change in terms of the way that people think about this over coming months, because the number of vaccine candidates that are coming up for approval or for a readout from their phase 3 trials, well, we may have the first one in less than a month. And Moderna is due on about the 21st of October. And then there are others that are somewhat later. So that does suggest that we do need to be thinking about, well, what's going to do well when the vaccine is widely available? And it's very clearly going to be social in nature. Then I think it's also particularly relevant that we're seeing resources sectors doing better. For example, Cemex in Mexico has now broken its downtrend. There are a significant number of shares that have been trending downwards for years and are now breaking their downtrends. And when we think about the potential, it is a lot easier to double from an all-time low or from a decade low than it is to double from an all-time high. And we've seen a phenomenal momentum move in technology. But what we're also seeing is that there is the clear scope that we're going to have renewed economic activity against a background where liquidity is extremely available, where there will be massive investments in infrastructure development, everything from housing to roads to bridges to new airports, and that is likely to be a global phenomenon. The example that China provided to all other emerging markets that building out an export-oriented manufacturing sector together with massive infrastructure development can deliver on economic growth and rising living standards, that's something that has been taken to heart by a large number of emerging markets. So India is talking about building a massive economic corridor and building new cities. I think it's upwards of 6 new cities between Mumbai and New Delhi, and creating a modern and green new economic corridor. Egypt is building a new Cairo in the middle of the desert. And then, of course, we've got the continued population explosion right across Africa. And it's one of the least infrastructure developed continents. So there's going to be a lot of infrastructure development over the course of the next decade in emerging markets. And of course, that is likely to be mirrored by infrastructure development in developed markets, because a lot of the infrastructure that's been built in the developed markets was built 40 to 60 to 80 years ago. So it is in vital need of renewal. And with millions of people unemployed, then governments need an easy way to get people back to work and to boost the velocity of money, and infrastructure development is an easy way to do that. So we're likely to see a significant infrastructure boom. And we are also seeing that industrial resources, everything from cement to iron ore to copper, is now rallying. And the LME Metals Index has broken its downtrend. So that is suggestive of a return to demand dominance. Soybeans have now completed a 2-year range and are right in the region of 1,000 cents. So this is going to be a significant Rubicon. Every time it has got up to 1,000 over the last 3 or 4 years, it's failed. So if it can sustain a move above at that level, then we are back in a demand-dominated environment. And then we're also seeing commonality right across the grain and bean sector. The corn market is also now firming from the lower side of a 6-year range. Wheat prices have got a base formation, and it's much more rounding than the other two, but it also is still in the base formation. It hasn't been able to break out just yet. Rough rice had surged initially following the introduction of the lockdowns. The price has subsequently come back down again. Now, if it can sustain a move back above around 13, well, then we're definitely back in a demand-dominated environment. The one missing ingredient to a commodity-led inflationary cycle is oil, and oil prices remain muted. Now, we are still in an environment where there is a lot of additional supply, but we also know that the number of bankruptcies in the energy sector has increased, and it's likely to increase further. And the spreads for high-yield energy bonds are now down to about 740 basis points. So they haven't quite unwound all of the big pop on the upside we had that accompanied the lockdowns, but we are likely to see additional stress in the oil sector because oil prices have not rebounded in a big dynamic fashion. And we're not going to see oil prices rally in a meaningful way until the supply surfeit has been worked down. Now, that may not occur for another few months, and it may be dependent on renewed economic activity on a global basis. But the reality is that the longer it goes on for, then the number of rigs that are in fact working is going to continue to decline. And the horizontal rig count is down and still at lows that haven't been seen for a decade. Now, the great thing about unconventional oil and gas is that it's very sensitive to prices. So all they need to do is stop drilling and supply will contract. And US supply has already fallen by 3 million barrels. So that's already a significant contraction, and it has room to contract further. Meanwhile, the number of miles being driven continues to increase, and gasoline prices are starting to march back up again, although they have been susceptible to some weakness over the course of the last couple of weeks. So that continues to suggest that we are still in an environment where energy is not going to lead commodities higher yet. But the fact that other commodities are rallying against a background where there isn't a push from higher oil prices, that speaks to a lot of internal strength in the commodity market. The reality is that commodities tend to be highly sensitive to inflationary pressures. So even though oil prices or energy prices generally are not a factor that is leading, because it was energy led on the upside in the early 2000s, it was the break of oil prices above $40 for the first time outside of wartime, that was a significant causal factor in the rising cost of production for all commodities. And that is not happening today. So this is much more about a limited supply argument for a lot of different resources. And obviously, that has been exaggerated by the pandemic and by plagues that we've had and fires that we've had this year. If that is sustainable beyond this year, then it's going to be a contributing factor in additional inflationary pressures. Then, of course, the big question is, if central banks are willing to continue to be aggressive in terms of leaving liquidity in the system and increasing liquidity during times of stress, then that's likely to be negative for the US dollar. A 200 basis point rise in the base rate for the USA would increase the national debt by would increase the servicing cost of the national debt by $100 billion a year. And that is just completely unrealizable. So there's just no way that they can allow interest rates to rise. And that pretty much holds out the real prospect of yield curve control. Now, central banks are still arguing about whether it's advisable, whether it's useful, or whether it's even possible. But the bond market is already behaving as if it's a fact rather than a conjecture. And as long as the yield curve continues to range below 70 basis points, then the conclusion is that investors are willing to give the benefit of the doubt to central banks, that they are willing to do whatever is necessary to hold down interest rates. And that's directly inflationary on a medium-term basis. It's the primary reason why gold is still very firm. Now, the price was negative in here today, and I think it is worth highlighting that there has been a succession of lower rally highs since the peak in early August. So we cannot rule out the potential that we are going to have a somewhat deeper pullback. But the reason that gold has outperformed in such a profound manner over the course of the last 2 years is because inflationary pressures are mounting. That the clear reality is that we are in a period of financial repression. And the last time financial repression was a major portion of the financial lexicon, or the kinds of things that people were willing to discuss, well, it was in the early 2000s when the Federal Reserve held down interest rates way longer than was necessary. They, in fact, inflated the housing bubble in the USA, but it was all in service to trying to support the economy by devaluing the currency. And that's exactly what they did immediately after the credit crisis, and gold prices also did phenomenally well. And we are nowhere near the end of that process today. So the dollar has really only just started going down. And commodities generally respond first to currency weakness. So that's part of the reason why it's not just gold that is doing better, but all commodities. Now, emerging markets generally do tend to move in line with commodities. And the Asia dollar index peaked in 2011. So the fact that the dollar started to stabilize, that robbed the emerging markets of the impetus. And there was obviously a push factor for international investors to invest in emerging markets and growth during periods of financial repression, because that's where you can pick up a yield, that's where you can pick up a positive interest rate. And they obviously then offer higher growth rates on top of that. When investors are less worried about the dollar, and the dollar is strong, well, then they don't have quite the same incentive to invest in emerging markets. So what happens with the Asia Dollar Index is going to be particularly relevant because emerging markets have lagged significantly over the last 6 to 7 months, and they've also been lagging for the last few years. We've looked at a significant number of shares that have been trending downwards for the last 2 years and were underperforming well before the pandemic hit. That's equally true of emerging markets. For example, the Indonesian market peaked at the beginning of 2018, and then it has also been underperforming for a good long time. Now, it pulled back in a violent manner yesterday, and then it rebounded in pretty emphatic fashion in here today. Now, I'm going to try and pull up, well, I can't remember the ticker, I'm afraid. The Indonesian government bonds are trading at yields in the region of about 6%. So the 7 year is up to 6.4, the 10 year is at 6.9. Now, those are significant yields. Now, of course, that means nothing when we don't have a strong currency. But if the dollar trends downwards and Asian currencies overall start to trend higher, not just on a short-term basis, but on a medium-term basis, then it's particularly relevant to look at the shape of the yield on the Indonesian bonds and then compare it to the currency chart because they're practically identical. So investors are using emerging market bonds as a proxy for currency trading, where they get to pick up significant yield spreads, but only when they've got the surety of the currency. Now, that's been the limiting factor on the performance of emerging markets in real terms over the last 6 months. There's been this question about whether their currencies are capable of rallying in a big way. The Chinese renminbi, though, has been steadying. It's gone from 7.2 to 6.8 in the space of the last few months. Now, it has paused around this level, but as long as the Chinese renminbi is not meaningfully accelerating lower, then it takes some of the pressure off of other emerging markets because they obviously compete with China as export markets, or for export markets, I should say. Now, there is obviously then the potential that with commodity prices starting to improve and with the potential for emerging market growth to massively outperform against a background where we've got financial repression in the USA and in Europe, well, then that does set up a potential outcome for emerging markets to outperform into 2021, but perhaps not quite yet, or at least not in as dynamic a manner just yet. This is probably the time to start building positions with a view to clear potential for outperformance next year, because we just don't have clear visibility on the coronavirus just yet. So that does represent an inhibiting factor for the emerging markets generally. But the fact that commodity prices continue to do well, then that is a significant factor. Then I thought it was also particularly relevant in here today that the leading movers on the S&P 500 were almost all in the industrial sector. The fact that Huntington Ingalls was the best performer, and if it follows through on the upside next week, then this will be a failed downside break. And if we do get a failed downside break, well, then it's quite likely to go back up and test the upper side of the range, which is at 200. So that could potentially be a meaningful change. Then we can also look at the providers for the automotive, or excuse me, the aeronautics sector, which have got very, that's the, excuse me, that is the wrong chart. Howmet Aerospace was the third best performer in here today, and it's also rebounding and shares a similar trajectory to a number of other industrials. The industrial sector generally has been doing particularly badly over the course of the coronavirus, but it does have space to perform if we're looking at a global recovery. So we've got resources that are doing better. We've got industrials that are doing better. Technology shares are really overbought. They've done spectacularly well, but valuations have increased. So they still have scope to continue to do well, provided we continue to see liquidity flowing into the market, which does appear likely. But their ability to continue to outperform is less impressive. Then when we look at some of the mining companies, sorry, put up the wrong ticker. For example, Southern Copper has pushed on to new recovery highs. Antofagasta, another copper miner, has been establishing itself above the 1,000 P level. These all represent sectors that have been not doing much for most of the last few years. They obviously have scope to perform in a more robust fashion, provided we get a real recovery in terms of global activity. The fact that cement companies are firming and are either breaking out or in the region of their long-term ranges is a significant factor. These, I think, are where we're going to see the biggest outperformance as we move from 2020 into 2021, because there is clear potential for significant investment, because you simply cannot have millions of people unemployed over the long term. That is just unacceptable from an economic perspective. Everything will have to be done to try and get them back to work, and that's going to require a great deal of spending. And the desired result is inflation. And when every country in the world is looking for the same result, then they're going to print enough money to ensure that it happens. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.